All right. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome you back to the third panel in our series today. We've heard a number of interesting discussions regarding indigenous politics and mobilizations in Ecuador and in Peru. And we'll now turn our attention to what is happening, the current state of play in Bolivia. And I have the pleasure of introducing three panelists this morning. We'll go in alphabetical order, so I will introduce them briefly. I know you have their biographical information, so you can take a look at the longer resumes that are printed there. In brief, Robert Albro teaches at the School of International Service at American University here in Washington, D.C. His area of focus is global cultural policymaking. Previously, he has taught at Wheaton College in Massachusetts and at George Washington University here in D.C. And he has a book coming out next spring called Midnight Roosters.
Yes? Roosters at Midnight.
At Midnight, I'm sorry. So, and I'll let him explain the more complicated subtitle, but it sounds very interesting. René Mayorga is senior researcher at the Centro Boliviano de Estudios Multidisciplinarios. He has previous teaching experience at Flaxo in Mexico and Flaxo in Ecuador, Brown University, and the University of Salamanca. And his work, which he will share with us today, focuses on democratization, political parties, and governance in the Andean region. Our third speaker is Carlos Toranzo. He is a political economist and consultant based in La Paz, Bolivia. He received his PhD in economics from the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, and he has taught at the University of Chile, Flaxo in Bolivia, and the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana in Mexico as well. So I will turn it over to Robert. We'll have about 15 minutes for each presentation and then plenty of time for discussion and questions.
So what I'm going to do is talk about Bolivia's new constitution primarily as a way to address the unique circumstances of Bolivia's indigenous movements and indigenous people at this historic conjuncture. The constitution was ratified earlier this year, and for now is, at least temporarily, a culmination of a long process of this country to shape the post-colonial terms of political participation, which has been historically defined by the profound marginalization of its indigenous and popular majority. We'll see what happens with this Sunday's elections in Bolivia, but we would expect further consolidation of MAS electoral dominance. Most recently, this struggle was carried forward by diverse indigenous and popular movements throughout the first half of the of this decade, with a regular call for a constitutional referendum, which became in turn a central plank for the successful candidacy of Evo Morales. Once in office in 2006, Morales and his movement towards socialism, or MAS, undertook what ended up to be a very grueling referendum process, punctuated by recurrent conflict and stalemates of various sorts throughout 2007 and 2008. This was especially true for the Department of Santa Cruz, which at times violently came out against the referendum. Nevertheless, upon the hard-fought passage of the new constitution, Morales victoriously declared, "Here begins the new Bolivia." So what I want to do is at least briefly take a first pass at describing what that new Bolivia looks like with an Aymara indigenous president and a party, the MAS party, dedicated to expanding indigenous rights and political representation, where the Constitution is a good way to allow us to kind of get a handle on the changing legal landscape in Bolivia with respect to indigenous peoples while in power, if you will, and as identified with the state, instead of talking about their relationship to the state. The new constitution suggests the extent to which the regular, just for parenthetically, the regular comparisons of Morales and his MAS party with Venezuela's Hugo Chavez and Chavismo and so forth is, I think, misleading. The tendency to group Bolivia with Ecuador, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, and so forth as part of a Latin American resurgent left and accompanying attention to Morales' occasional anti-U.S. bellicosity, in my view, renovate a kind of Cold War frame of reference in the absence of other frames to use in identifying different post-neoliberal turns by different countries through the late 90s into the 2000s. In fact, I think we're best off viewing Morales and Lamas's attempt to, in their terms, reinvent democratic socialism in the terms of Bolivia's own unique post-colonial trajectory, its efforts to come to terms with what was until recently a largely disenfranchised indigenous demographic majority. And so I'll describe what that looks like. The Constitution has, for now, capped off what has been an ongoing process that began really with the most recent political legal horizon would have to be the 1952 state. I'm not going to talk about that, but more recently in the mid-90s, in conjunction with or complementary to or at the same time as we had neoliberal structural adjustment in Bolivia, we also had a series of multicultural legal changes and constitutional transformations in the meaning of citizenship rights. This included policies of decentralization, and this was the beginning, really, of what is this new citizenship regime with the new constitution. All of this can be broadly characterized as a kind of gradual legal, political movement away from the mestizo assimilationist commitments of the 1952 state in different ways, inspired by benchmarks like the ILO Convention 169. The 1994 constitutional changes redescribed the state as pluricultural and multicultural and pluriethnic. Article 171, for the first time, stated formally recognized the economic, cultural rights, social, economic, cultural rights of the country's indigenous peoples. Importantly, including specific legal recognition of traditional authorities of indigenous and campesino communities. And so I want to just emphasize with reference to the ILO convention that the coming into legislative focus of indigenous rights in Bolivia has not just been in response to direct action mobilizations during this period, this very dynamic period of 2000 to 2005 or so, but also in response to transnational and hemispheric indigenous mobilizing, organizing, advocacy, activism, in which Morales in particular, before becoming president, had been very proactive. I want to also emphasize as a key precedent the 1994 popular participation law in Bolivia, which further changed the social and cultural landscape of citizenship in that country. There's a lot of discussion of this moment, and I won't go into some of those details, but I'll simply note that the popular participation law formally recognized the wide variety of traditional local or grassroots associations, including organizations like juntas vecinales, neighborhood committees, sindicatos agrarios, you know, agrarian unions, and indigenous ayllus, this term referring to a sort of pre-colonial social, political, territorial grouping. Identifying them and equating all of them as territorial base organizations. Indigenous and popular representatives of these OTBs, these territorial base organizations, could further serve as part of a committee overseeing the work of local municipal government or run for local office themselves. Some commentators have stressed the role of the popular participation law as a critical moment in its complementarity to the efforts to deepen and to establish neoliberal policy in Bolivia, let's say as part of the state's effort to co-opt potentially dissenting voices into the formal procedures of governance. But there's two sides to this story, and the other side of it is that the popular participation law really did open up new kinds of local political spaces for indigenous and campesino actors. Not only did it give traditional forms of local political organization a new specifically political role, but it acted as a kind of a doorway for indigenous and campesino leaders into local municipal government. Perhaps most importantly, the popular participation law gave legal validity to so-called customary law, to usos y costumbres. And in so doing, it created an incentive to articulate local grievances and political claims in the terms of cultural rights. So, for example, during the onset of social movement activism, direct action protest in 2000 with the Cochabamba water war, you saw rural irrigators advancing their claims in the terms of usos y costumbres. And then again, during the protracted run-up to defining participation or the terms of participation in what became the constitutional referendum in 2006, political claims and representation in terms of usos y costumbres were articulated as largely indigenous goals and repeatedly presented as a preferred option by indigenous groups and understood as efforts to deepen the participatory citizenship of the so-called communitarian democracy of the country's indigenous or originario nations. National legal reforms leading up to the Constitution of 2009, in short, have provided political openings for the expansion of the category, indigenous, in national political life in a variety of ways. So this is the immediate background to how the Constitution has translated and represented the regular demands by popular and indigenous protest movements during the years 2000 to 2005 and well before in the terms of greater autonomy. And I want to dwell for a moment on the autonomy. The question of autonomy has been a flashpoint in a variety of ways across the Bolivian landscape. In May of 2008, the Department of Santa Cruz held a regional autonomy referendum calling for greater regional control, mostly water, land, gas. The vote was judged to be both unconstitutional and illegal by the Bolivian government as a separatist expression of opposition among the region's political and economic elites to the approval of the then draft constitution. But it's important to note that in an interesting and maybe unexpected turn, the Santa Cruz call for autonomy was appropriated, in a sense, from the ongoing call for autonomy and self-determination, which had been the centerpiece of multiple indigenous movements in Bolivia and internationally for some time. Just to give you a quick roster of some of the ways that has looked over the previous decades, Aymara Cataristas of the 1970s, for example, emphasized self-determination as a distinct indigenous nation and as separate from a plurinational Bolivian state. José Antonio Lucero, for example, reminds us in his recent book that that kind of Catarista-style Indian nationalism in Bolivia has meant, typically more precisely meant, Aymara nationalism. The Lowland to Highland 1990 March for Territory and Dignity, in its turn, issued a call for autonomous indigenous control over its own territory. Autonomy became this territorial concern quite explicitly after that point. Throughout the 80s and 90s, the Cocaleros of the Chapare conjoined a continuous fight for local union autonomy with the themes of national sovereignty and of a distinct autochthonous culture in defense of the coca leaf in the context of the U.S. war on drugs. This emerged gradually as the Cocalero movement became increasingly indigenized, let's say, moving from a campesino agrarian discourse to something else. During the same period, Aymara indigenous intellectuals and historians in Bolivia have worked to quote-unquote, reconstitute the IU as a political act of decolonization and as a kind of counterpublic, if you will, to the Bolivian state, representing a restoration of the traditional Andean community with its right to self-governance and self-determination. During the onset of popular and indigenous protests in 2000, then-leader of the Unified Confederation of Rural Bolivian Workers, or CSUTCB, Felipe Quispe, proposed an Indian law, Ley Indio, which would include indigenous control over land reform, distribution of titles and territories. So at the same time, throughout the 70s into the 2000s and so forth, Bolivia's diverse indigenous currents more sharply connected their various goals to those of the growing hemispheric and transnational indigenous movement across Latin America, incorporating such differently mixed goals as self-determination, self-governance, collective entities, recognition of cultural distinctiveness, territorial rights, and economic auto-development. And as I've argued elsewhere about the MAS, the emergence of Morales and the MAS in Bolivia is in large part owed to its successful articulation of, circulating national and international conceptions of class, culture, indigenous and national autonomy and sovereignty as a way to build a coalition of overlapping political interests and agencies under the growing umbrella of indigenous rights. The discourse of autonomy and self-determination, in short, proved to be an effective means to mobilize Bolivia's several grassroots popular and indigenous movements, primarily in response to the neoliberal state. Together with the recent assertions of regional autonomy, these multiple ways of imagining and of enacting autonomies have engaged each other within Bolivia's popular and indigenous movements during the past decade in these kind of fruitfully coalitional ways. Now the MAS governs, however, so that was then. In late 2009, on the eve of a new round of elections in which the MAS should do well, a majority of such rights have been formally incorporated into Bolivia's new constitution. So very briefly, the constitution's Article 1 takes the unusual step of identifying the Bolivian state as both plurinational and communitarian. Starting with Article 2, it also regularly distinguishes indigenous rights from other rights by attaching them to a subject it describes as pueblos indígena originario campesinos. We can say more about that, but it's clearly an effort to englobe the various different categories of a potential indigenous agency into one, you know, overall unifying category. The Constitution confirms the fact of what it calls indigenous first peoples or peasant autonomy, autonomía indígena originaria campesina, in multiple articles throughout the 411 articles that compose the Constitution. Equating autonomy with self-governance and with the right to culture. The Constitution goes on to assert a wide variety of specific cultural rights for indigenous peoples, including recognition of indigenous languages as official languages of the state, asserting that the moral, ethical basis of Bolivia's plural society relies on and is derived from or inspired by indigenous cosmological principles such as to live well, and the state's embrace of a democratic, participatory, representative, and communitarian form of government inspired directly by indigenous communities. It also embraces intercultural education and recognizes, perhaps most controversially, at least in the process of the constitutional referendum, traditional indigenous systems of community justice. Bolivia's constitution significantly takes its cue, and the timing is, of course, clear, from the 2007 UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And as George Gray Molina has noted, the new constitution recognizes explicit collective group rights for indigenous communities. And so doing, it also defines what counts as indigenous identity, perhaps most clearly in Article 30, and this is how it defines who is indigenous. The nation and pueblo of indigenous first peoples and campesinos comprise all collective humanity who share a cultural identity, language, historical tradition, institutions, territoriality, and cosmovision, and whose existence is anterior to the Spanish colonial invasion. We should note the emphasis here upon clear criteria for defining the distinctiveness of indigenous identity as a collective category apart, with distinct rights, and in fact prior to the existence of the Bolivian state itself, busily doing the work of defining the legal authority for what counts as indigenous identity. Throughout the Constitution's articles, it is this historically composite rights-bearing indigenous subject that is aligned with the state's direct and participatory communitarian identity, which in Article 11 includes the referendum, the deliberative processes of the assembly and the cabildo, the public or union meeting, alongside other established culturally specific communitarian processes for democratic decision-making, designation of political authorities among indigenous groups, etc., all as distinguished from the individual vote, or as Sayla Ben Habib has aptly put it, the legal vision of the individual as a self-interpreting being. While a broad variety of individual rights are spelled out in the Constitution in Articles 15 to 29 and elsewhere, Articles 30 to 32 define distinct indigenous rights. Throughout the Constitution, collective indigenous political, economic, social, cultural, and territorial rights are spelled out in detail, establishing a legal framework for the autonomy of the communitarian democracy of Bolivia's indigenous people. Otherwise, the Constitution codifies this distinction through a frequent shorthand of individual and collective, quote-unquote, when specifying additional kinds of rights. Ultimately, this individual-collective axis is the basis for discriminating cultural from other rights in the Constitution. And this is, of course, consistent with the ways that cultural rights are differentiated from ordinary rights and obligations among liberal multicultural theorists of citizenship and in other state-based constitutional efforts globally to legislate recognition of a country's cultural pluralism. And so just to conclude, even while several commentators in Latin America have pointed to the cultural characteristics of what we might call different policy concerns or doxas as neoliberalism in Bolivia's constitution and in broader political efforts to make different minority or indigenous subjects fully legible, indigenous claims are interpreted here as uniquely cultural claims, in turn treated as a value added to citizenship. In this respect, Bolivia's new constitution amounts to a legal articulation of what we might call an activist scholarship vision of, for example, the Ayllu as an indigenous cultural and political project. Even as we must recognize the historic extent of enfranchisement of Bolivia's indigenous peoples represented by the new constitution, at the same time, the legal fact of this autonomy described in the new constitution, I suggest, can also narrow how indigenous identity might be recognized by the Bolivian state to a set of equations between autonomy, territorial integrity, collective rights, and cultural citizenship. It remains to be seen how these constitutional precedents will transform the political standing of Bolivia's indigenous peoples, but the constitution is largely silent, for example, about Bolivia's fastest-growing indigenous demographic, which is a decidedly urban indigenous population. That's not particularly well identified here, or identified at all in collective cultural terms. In this sense, the constitution, for all its liberatory goals, has the potential, anyway, to limit the spectrum of indigenous experience in ways reversing field from the earlier big tent strategy that the MAS so ably employed in its rise to power and to governance, and which included a very expansive appreciation of indigenous rights. And I'll stop here.
Thank you very much. We'll now turn to René Mayorga.
Thank you. I would like first to thank Ambassador Peter Dichasso for his kind invitation to participate in this conference. And I will address mainly three questions. The first one, what is the institutional and political state of indigenous movement today in Bolivia? The second one, political conflicts and obstacles in the process of promoting an indigenous policy agenda. And the third one, I will address some questions about perspectives of indigenous politics in Bolivia. Let me start distinguishing three dimensions regarding the present state of the indigenous movement in Bolivia: the constitutional dimension, the policy dimension, and the political dimension. Regarding the first one, following Evo Morales' rise to power, the key aim of the MAS government, as we know, has been the refounding of Bolivia from an ethno-Aymara nationalist perspective. Important claims, in fact, of the indigenous movement, albeit with some modifications, have been incorporated into the new constitution approved by a contentious referendum in February 2009. The constitution established a plurinational state creating 36 indigenous nations, introduced a dual system of citizenship, a dual system of justice, and far-reaching changes strengthening the status of indigenous peoples. First, the devolution of power to Indian communities by creating indigenous autonomies, which entail the control and reconstitution of land and ancestral territories. Second, by establishing special indigenous electoral districts. Third, by recognizing the constitutional status of the communitarian justice in the framework of two systems of justice, or two estados de derecho. And fourth, by introducing a provision making possible an equal participation in state powers like the constitutional tribunal. Moreover, coca leaf production has been enshrined in the constitution, providing the legitimation for a specific policy of re-evaluation of the sacred coca leaf. Regarding the policy agenda, I think it is necessary to put forward two questions. The first one, to which extent has the ethno-nationalist ideology defined the government policy toward the indigenous bases of the MAS? And the second one is whether there is any coherent agrarian policy in favor of indigenous peoples. As I have laid out, some principles of this ideology have been enshrined in the Constitution, but in a less radical orientation than that espoused by indigenous organizations like CONAMAC and CIDOP. My basic contention is that the government has not an agenda reflecting the ethno-nationalist ideology, nor it has designed and implemented a coherent and efficient agrarian policy. There are some disconnected pieces. For example, the government has provided support to about 9,000 small producers through the so-called Empresa de Apoyo a la Producción de Alimentos. Second, based on the law of reinforcement of Indian communities and the National Plan of Land Distribution, the government has distributed between 2006 and 2009 about 1 million hectares, benefiting about 100,000 peasant families in La Paz, Santa Cruz, Beni, Pando, and Tarija. So the key policy aim to carry out a radical agrar reform in the tropical lowlands has not gone beyond a partial and limited land distribution. However, there is only one explicit and broadly successful policy, which is in fact the nitty-gritty of Evo's policy, the unwavering support to coca production. According to the last report of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, the surface of coca cultivating has increased from about 26,000 hectares in 2005 to 30,500 hectares in 2008, about 20% increase. And the cocaine production has increased from 80 tons in 2005 to 113 tons in 2008, what means a 40% increase. As a result, the only real beneficiaries of government policy have been the coca producers of Chapare and the Yungas, who are apparently very happy with the present boom of coca production, and of course do not need to worry about the dangerous boom of cocaine production and drug trafficking in Bolivia. Regarding the political state of indigenous movement, I think the first factor to stress is the demise of the social movement as such, which, as we know, was based on a network of different indigenous and urban organizations, like the Coca Growers Federation of the Chapare, the Neighborhood Associations of El Alto, the Central Obrera Regional del Alto, the Confederation of the United Confederation of Peasants. There is no currently there is no more indigenous movement, but the corporative defense of the interests of peasant organizations and indigenous communities under the protection of the government itself. The main causes of the demise of the once powerful indigenous movement have been, in my judgment, first, the Indian and peasant organizations believe that the constitutional agenda, constituent assembly, new constitution, nationalization of national resources, and consequently the key objectives of the social movement have been accomplished. The demands of indigenous movements from the Andean region and the Amazonian lowlands seem to have been fulfilled. Second, the indigenous organizations have compelling reasons to think that the rise to power of their leader, Evo Morales, was a huge political triumph of the indigenous movement, which in fact constituted comparatively a unique phenomenon and a political watershed in the Andean region. Thus, the social movement faded at the pinnacle of its great success. Third, the most salient metamorphosis of the mass as a dual political and social movement has been its mutation into a ruling party. given its self-understanding and as the self-representation of the masses turn, malgré lui, into a political party, which is now controlled by a small group of professional politicians who exercise power on behalf of the so-called indigenous movement. Fourth, this change became apparent in the forming of the government and the selection of state officials which do not reflect the ideological claim that the mass government is a government of the social movements themselves, based on the self-representation of the masses. Except some isolated appointments, like the appointment of David Cáceres, leader of the Chapare Coca peasant unions, as undersecretary in charge of anti-narcotics policy, indigenous or peasant representatives have not directly participated in government affairs. Finally, and most importantly, the masses' leadership prevails now over the peasant and indigenous organizations. This predominance entails a significant turnaround of previous bottom-up linkages between Evo Morales and peasant unions, fostering in turn top-down hierarchical and authoritarian structures and linkages to its core social base. Evo's powerful control over the social organizations of the mass has allowed him to mobilize them even as shock troops in strategic violent confrontations against political opponents. What have been the political conflicts in the process of promoting an indigenous agenda? This process was conflict-ridden, particularly during the phase of intended constitutional change in the Constituent Assembly in a scenario of polarization and stalemate. Since it did not have a two-thirds majority, the mass put into practice in this stage its well-known double strategy of institutional politics and mass mobilization. The Constituent Assembly stalled about a year because it could not agree on decision rules, despite the fact that the law convoking the Constituent Assembly foresaw a provision to make decisions by two-thirds of votes. The mass was unwilling to negotiate and achieve agreements with the opposition, and the opposition rejected in turn the radical proposals of the mass. As a result, there was no debate about the basic issues of constitutional change, mainly on the issue of decentralization and regional autonomy. The constitutional change, moreover, driven by the mass, has entirely been anti-constitutional and illegal, both in its objectives and in its procedures. First, the new constitution aims at the thorough authoritarian power concentration and centralization and at establishing arbitrary, unbounded power structures amidst fragmentation of state competences by creating two new autonomies, indigenous and regional autonomies. The procedures leading to its sweeping approval in the Constituent Assembly in December 2007, 411 articles were passed in 16 hours, were contra legem, breaching the general rules of the Constituent Assembly and the extant Constitution. Consequently, the Constitutional Assembly failed to work out a consensus-based constitution. What came out was the anti-constitutional and illegal approval of mass constitution in Sucre and Oruro, which was repudiated by the political and regional opposition. The massive failure of the Assembly became apparent as Congress assumed the task to debate the mass constitution, again in a context of peasant mobilizations and siege against the parliamentary opposition and the stronghold of regional opposition in Santa Cruz. In fact, the mass strategy was a military one. It aimed at imposing its constitution by violent means. The country got on the brink of armed confrontation, and the Bolivian state got close to the status of a failed state. Bolivia's political polarization and deadlock turned into a regional problem, prompting the intervention of UNASUR, under whose tutelage and patronage the government and the political opposition finally reached an agreement, leading with minor amendments to the passing of the mass constitution by Congress in October 2008. Certainly, the new constitution was ratified by a constitutional referendum in February 2009, albeit with serious indications of altered voter registration, fraud manipulation, and the imposition of induced voting, what we call el voto consigna. Moreover, this referendum brought to light, again, the deep regional fractures characterizing Bolivian politics. Finally, the question about the promotion of the indigenous agenda. Given the politics carried out in the last 4 years by the MAS government, I think it became clear that the indigenous ideology has brought to bear mainly on constitutional change, but it has not provided a set of guidelines for implementing concrete policies. It has rather been a useful ideological tool for justifying a constitutional recasting aiming at the far-reaching concentration of power in the executive. Second, this is evident in the candidate selection made by the MAS for the coming election, which has not taken into account the demands of indigenous organizations like the CONAMAC to select candidates of indigenous communities. Instead, the MAS leadership preferred mostly candidates of peasant and urban unions, as well as middle-class groups, in an outright attempt to reach out to urban middle class, mainly because of these short-term electoral interests, the MAS opted for getting away from ethno-nationalist ideological principles. And third aspect is that the government's indigenous agenda has provoked many intractable contradictions in dealing with the claims of indigenous communities in the Andean region and the Amazonian lowlands. These problems reveal serious obstacles of democratic governance brought about by the Constitution itself. Even before the implementation, the new Constitution gives us enough evidence of what might happen in the next future in terms of governance. I give two examples. Based on the new constitution, Indian communities have already taken control of about 20 mining companies in the Altiplano provinces of La Paz, claiming property rights, benefits, direct taxation, and compensation by the mining companies. An Amazonian ethnic, the Mosetenes, in the north of La Paz, that's the second example, clashed with the government over the issue of oil exploitation plans. The Mosetenes reject this government plan mainly on environmental grounds. Which are the perspectives for indigenous politics? The significant question is now whether the MAS will be capable of promoting its indigenous policy agenda, implementing its constitution, particularly in three domains: the establishment of indigenous autonomies, the enhancement of the indigenous systems of justice, and the carrying out of a thorough agrar reform. The implementation of the constitutional provisions in these domains will probably lead to chaotic situations and further weaken state capacities. Even if the MAS wins the presidential and parliamentary elections next Sunday by 2/3 of the votes, as it anxiously expects, achieving this way the absolute control of both the Senate and the Chamber of Deputies, Morales will have to face formidable structural pitfalls. 1 minute more. One of these pitfalls is cultural and political. According to the Constitution, there are some 36 nations defined on the premises of language and culture. However, none of these so-called nations, not even the Aymaras, have explicitly evinced the political will to create nations. some kind of political structures deserving this concept. In fact, except some indigenous communities in the northern provinces of La Paz and in Santa Cruz, for example, in the Guarani region, the overwhelming majority does not make a claim for the establishment of indigenous autonomies based on their supposedly national identities. This new guiding constitutional principle was, in fact, rather an artful device of ideologues, both national and foreigners. The second pitfall is institutional and thwarts the viability of indigenous autonomies. Again, with some exceptions in the Aymara and Quechua provinces, the indigenous communities do not have any institutional capabilities for developing autonomies. They do not have even the basic demographic underpinnings. For example, the Yukis, an ethnic from the Chapare region, has only about 180 people. The Wenhayek in the Chaco region, only about 100 people. They are incapable of even establishing a municipality. So in a scenario in which the indigenous movement has faded, Evo's hegemony over peasant organizations seems to be total. But this does not warrant the implementation of his indigenous policy agenda, save for the COCA policy, the cornerstone of his indigenous peasant agenda. I'm not sure, but the elections will probably bring about the revival and persistence of polarization and deadlock, curbing the project of total domination of Evo's government. As a consequence, the resulting political paralysis would stave off especially the implementation of radical agrar reform in the lowlands. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We now turn to our third speaker, Carlos Toranzo, please.
Gracias al embajador de Chazo por la invitación. Voy a hablar en español porque mi inglés es pésimo y no porque lo haya prohibido el presidente Morales. Voy a hablar de política indígena en Bolivia, o lo que yo llamaría la paradoja de las nuevas exclusiones. Y pensando con cabeza comparativa de lo que hemos oído en los paneles de la mañana, yo diría, si en Perú el Estado no mira lo indígena, en Bolivia el Estado, o para el Estado, todo es indígena. Esa es la división, la separación. Ahora, Bolivia es un país de mayorías indígenas. Bueno, para cuanto lector extranjero hay, sí, porque leen solamente el censo de 2001, donde se planteaba que Bolivia tenía 63% de población indígena. No más que en ese censo, los antropólogos que diseñaron la boleta pusieron 5 opciones de 5 pueblos originarios y no había la opción de anotar una cruz en mestizo o boliviano. Entonces, el resultado no salió así. 63%, más o menos parecido al censo de 1950. Pero desde 1990, en los informes de Naciones Unidas o los informes que hace la Universidad de Pittsburgh, preguntando la autopercepción de la gente, los datos salen consistentemente, 66% a 70% mestizos, 18% originarios y con Evo ha subido a 22%. Claro, este 4% corresponde a muchos españoles, catalanes, jóvenes high class que ahora más cancoquis se sienten indígenas. Esto es la autopercepción, cómo se siente uno. Entonces tenemos evidencias de que se habla de Bolivia como un país de mestizos, o hay que hablar así, pero inundado este país por un discurso profundamente indigenista. Pero lo que hay que cuidar es que no es país de mestizos según lo miraba la revolución de 1952, como un solo tipo de mestizos. Estamos hablando de decenas de mestizos muy rurales, esos del alto, de mestizos un poco más urbanos, pero lo curioso es de mestizos hoy invisibilizados por el discurso profundamente indigenista. Y acá hay un problema de democracias. Esto es la nueva exclusión. Los antes excluidos discursivamente desde el Estado excluyen a otros, al mundo del cholaje del cual yo formo parte, por ejemplo. Pero esto del mundo de los mestizos no quiere decir que la cuestión indígena no exista, no sea profunda, no sea de importancia. Es un tema crucial en Bolivia Y más todavía si combina el tema de lo indígena con la pobreza. Porque lo más duro de la pobreza, obviamente, es rural en Bolivia. Y además, es profundamente importante el tema indígena por el tipo de movilizaciones centenarias que existen. La movilización de Túpac Katari es antes de la República, lo cual hay que tomarlo muy en cuenta. Su núcleo político era anticolonial, como es parte del discurso del más ahora. Hay una lectura de largo plazo o una secuencia de largo plazo en el tema anticolonial. El levantamiento de Zárate Vilca, de 1899, la Revolución Federal en unión con los federales, posiciona un tema que es nodal en Bolivia. Se discutía en ese entonces el tema de la tierra, exactamente igual que lo que se discute al inicio del siglo XXI. A pesar de la Revolución del 52, el tema de la tierra no fue solucionado. Y es un tema nodal y que probablemente avance por ahí el gobierno del MAS y no tanto en otras demandas, sino en un tema en el cual se puede hacer política pública. Política pública que se hizo en parte con la Revolución de 1952. El Congreso Indigenal, en 1943, durante un régimen militar nacionalista revolucionario, curiosos parecidos con el nacionalismo revolucionario militar que apoya al presidente Morales, visibilizó también el tema indígena en dicho Congreso. Pero post-revolución de 1952, ya no se hablaba del indio, de movimiento de indios, sino de campesinos. Se convirtió al indio en clase social. Y con la OIT, otras finezas intelectuales, ahora se ha transitado de indio campesino a pueblo originario e indígena. Es también un constructo conceptual que rescata realidad, pero hay constructos intelectuales en las formas a través de las cuales se van a fijar conceptos para leer determinados fenómenos políticos, sociales y sociológicos. Y esos campesinos del 52 fueron parte del gobierno revolucionario del MNR, como hoy los campesinos son parte del gobierno del MAS. Hoy en Bolivia es difícil dividir Estado de sociedad. Es casi exactamente la misma cosa. Pero en nuestra memoria histórica está que hay un proceso de autonomía, de separación conforme pasa el tiempo, donde la sociedad se autonomiza del Estado al cual entró o por el cual fue absorbido. Ahora, en la primera exposición se habló de los cataristas. Y los cataristas muestran en la década de los 70 y del 80 algo central. Reivindican no temas como se han planteado ahora en la mesa de defensa del medio ambiente, pelea por los hidrocarburos, por los minerales. No, temas más profundos. Identidad, dignidad, cultura, religión, forma de hablar, que son mucho más estructurales que un simple tema de estar hablando de que nos oponemos a determinadas políticas de multinacionales respecto del uso de hidrocarburos o de minería. Y esos catarismos, más que ser movimientos políticos, fueron movimientos culturales. Y lo que permitieron con su impronta intelectual fue visibilizar la diversidad en Bolivia y poner en el centro del tapete de la discusión del mundo de los mestizos. Es curioso, pero el movimiento catarista hizo eso, visibilizó a los cholos, visibilizó a los mestizos, los puso en juego para no leer solo a una sociedad como sociedad blanca o de oligarquías. Pero, por supuesto, que también fincaron la idea de combate contra el neocolonialismo, como lo rescata hoy el MAS en una idea, tal cual lo ha planteado René, de refundación de la República, de eliminación de todas las instituciones coloniales. Ahora, en el 90, lo más impresionante de movilización indígena fue que Bolivia descubrió a los indígenas de tierras bajas. Porque antes los indígenas eran solo aymaras, eran tierras altas, y marcharon por territorio y dignidad. Esto ya es profundo, ya no es tierra, como en el 52, ya es territorio. Y hoy el MAS lo lleva a que cada nacionalidad, que cada nación posea jurisdicción propia, que emita leyes o que construya estados, lo cual complica el futuro, como has planteado tú, en términos de manejo de la gobernabilidad. Y claro, lo que se logró con este movimiento de los 90 fue
el intento de reafirmar la diversidad, el intento de revitalizar la idea de multiculturalidad y multietnicidad, que se fija, como lo planteaste tú, en la Constitución del 94. El país se reconoce como multicultural, como multiétnico. Es un salto. Pero el siguiente no lo hemos dado. No es intercultural. Porque sabemos que somos distintos, pero no podemos convivir con el otro. Este es un tema nodal. Claro que sí. No se avanza a conectarse entre los distintos. Ese es un reto del futuro. Y tal cual viene el discurso profundamente étnico de la etnopolítica, no contribuye a esta interculturalidad, a generar estos vasos comunicantes entre unos y otros. Los cocaleros son indígenas. Son campesinos, para decirlo bien, o son migrantes urbanos al mundo rural, como lo es el presidente Morales. Presidente Morales nació en comunidad originaria, fue criado, amasado por sacerdotes, fue músico en Oruro, es decir, un sujeto mixto con algo de mestizaje. Es que no podemos ser, en el concepto de la definición de lo indígena, ser indígena solo porque hablo como indígena, tengo cara de indígena, visto como indígena, sino también como me autopercibo. Pero no podemos llegar al extremo de que cuanto americano llegue a Bolivia, con su mochila, mastique coca, tenga morral, se autoperciba como indígena y es un indígena más. Hay extremos, y debemos cuidar definicionalmente este tema de las definiciones de lo indígena, porque al hacerla más laxa, estamos violentando una concepción conceptual de aquello que queremos definir. Pero obviamente ahí estamos hablando en el Chapare más de un mundo campesino que indígena. Obviamente con sellos de comunidad como tiene todo cocalero, como tiene el presidente Morales. Ahora, los discursos políticos del 2000 venían preñados de indigenismo. No. Los discursos desde 1946 vienen preñados de sindicalismo revolucionario. Si algo hay en la cabeza de los bolivianos, en la conducta de los bolivianos, tenemos una mente sindical. El sindicato se siente partido y debe tomar el poder. El sindicato es contraestatal. Y esto se percibe muy poco en el análisis del MAS y del gobierno del presidente Morales. ¿Cómo se hace el mix entre una cultura política de sindicalismo revolucionario con esta suma de ideas indigenistas o etnonacionalismo? Y uno se da cuenta que ese sindicalismo revolucionario lo que tiene como nostalgia de política pública es la construcción del Estado empresario. Estado benefactor, quizá. Más Estado empresario, antiimperialista, nacionalizador. Eso que hace como política pública el presidente Morales y que para términos indígenas puede hacer como otra reforma agraria en las Highlands, en las tierras altas. Pero más allá, las políticas públicas indigenistas son difíciles porque en realidad la mente, la cultura política del MAS y del presidente Morales es de nacionalismo revolucionario, de sindicalismo revolucionario que ama las nacionalizaciones, el antiimperialismo, no más que ahora nacionalismo y nacionalizaciones en épocas de globalización quiere decir economía mixta, quiere decir aceptar la inversión extranjera. Pero lo que uno siente con el presidente Morales es que desde el poder se ha armado con más fuerza el discurso indigenista, porque es un discurso extraordinario de legitimación. No hay sueco, holandesa, alemán que no caiga puesto de rodillas ante el presidente Morales por el sexapil del discurso indigenista. Es la tuti, es antineoliberal, antiglobalización y proindigenista. Es la tuti, la tiene toda. Eso es legitimación. Pero hoy no hay candidatos indígenas, no hay políticas indígenas para saber por dónde va la mano. La mano va por algunas clases medias y va básicamente por mundos campesinos, por juntas de vecinos, por centrales obreras regionales, que es el alma del MAS, y eso tenemos que verlo muy bien. Ahora, obviamente, CONAMAC, SIDOB han sido profundamente fortalecidos, empoderados en estos años. Además, las cooperaciones internacionales, incluido Estados Unidos, en 20 años, ¿qué han hecho? Empowerment of civil society. That's it, no more. No hablar de partidos políticos, no hablar de sistema político. Y claro, cuando venía la globalización, los antiglobalizadores se globalizaron también, las ONGs. que se han convertido en los think tanks radicales del presidente Correa, del chavismo. Si hasta la señora que hacía marxismo geométrico, Marta Harnack, era revivido. Y obviamente, esas ONGs se han convertido en think tanks de estos sectores radicales. Y mucho europeo que nos lleva a Bolivia para hacer revoluciones que no han podido hacer en sus países. Bueno, entonces es muy, muy cómodo esto. Ahora, el más resalta las diferencias de nacionalidades, de etnias, emite un discurso multicultural, pero en realidad no es multicultural, es monocultural, es aymaracéntrico. No importan otras etnias, otras culturas, lo central es aymara, ni siquiera a quechua llega. Esto tenemos que observarlo bien. Y de las diferencias culturales estamos avanzando a choque de civilizaciones. Que esto ya es peligroso, donde ya tiene que ver con la imposibilidad de que el otro sea aceptado. Y la construcción vía constitucional de las naciones con jurisdicción propia, Estado, en realidad va a ser un problema. El presidente Morales va a ganar las elecciones que vienen por goleada, no por fraude. Los va a barrer a sus enemigos. Pero al intentar aplicar su constitución, se va a tropezar en su propio hecho, en la propia letra de su constitución, que no le da viabilidad de seguir adelante si es que la trata de implantar tal cual viene, desmontando todo, todas las instituciones. Ya nos pusieron un decreto, ¿dónde? Ya no bandera boliviana, sino huipala. Pero el boliviano de la escuela rural más lejana tiene rojo, amarillo y verde en su cabeza. El límite de la ley, el límite del decreto. Las instituciones son costumbres, no solo son leyes. Y esas cosas, o algunas cosas, se van a mantener. Entonces, para nosotros tenemos una esquizofrenia. Un país que se urbaniza cada vez más, pero tiene un discurso indigenista. Un poder económico que se traslada cada vez más a Santa Cruz y hacia el sur, pero el poder político sigue en La Paz. Y la discusión central sobre la democracia. ¿La democracia es solo gobierno de mayorías o también es respeto de minorías? Creo que esos son los issues que estamos discutiendo en Bolivia. Gracias.
Thank you to our three panelists. We've had a very comprehensive and complementary discussion about the political implications of legal, historical, and cultural discourses around what it means to be indigenous, the issue of rights, the issue of land reform, and the good thing is we have plenty of time for discussion. So as you raise your hands take the microphone, please remember to turn the microphone on because we are trying to capture this for our web, and state your name and your affiliation, and let's take a round of questions, maybe four or five questions, and then we'll allow our panelists to respond. Yes, please.
My name is Mick Anderson. I'm with the Center for Hemispheric Defense Studies, and I must say my question is a personal question. It doesn't represent the Department of Defense or the National Defense University or the Center. I'd like to tell really briefly a little story. 1995, I went to Bolivia trying to take advantage of the popular participation law. I went for the Justice Department, U.S. Justice Department, and I set up a draft proposal for a rural police in Bolivia, which included using derecho consuetudinario or traditional law, based in part on U.S. models. We had the approval of the vice president of the country, Victor Hugo Cárdenas. We had approval from the head of the national police. We had the full backing of the FBI. And we got to the point where it was being elevated up the embassy chain of command, and the political officer killed it. He said he was from Wyoming, and being from Wyoming, he knew Indians weren't interested in justice. It's an actual quote. I've been doing this for a long time, and since we're here in Washington, I'd like to ask the question. I've always said that there's more Indians in Latin America than there are Argentines. We spend a lot of time on Argentina and not very much time in terms of indigenous peoples. It reminds me of Custer's last words, which were supposedly, "I wonder where all these damned Indians are coming from." What do you all think can the United States do? Because it's not doing very much. And I have fear, and I think some of the speakers today have highlighted that fact, that neo-Marxists and radical populists are hijacking the legitimate demands of Native Americans in Latin America. What do you think the United States could do to change that situation? Thank you.
There's another question over here in the front, please.
Hi, Raul Madrid of University of Texas. So my question is, I mean, if Evo Morales and the MAS are as Aymara-centric as you suggest, I mean, what explains their degree of electoral success among mestizos, among Quechua-speaking people, et cetera? I mean, what? How would you explain this contradiction?
Excuse me, over here in the corner?
Patricia Vasquez from the U.S. Institute of Peace. One of the panelists mentioned the fact that part of the discourse of President Morales does not really represent the reality. For example, the nationalization of natural resources was not really a nationalization. It was a rewriting of the contracts with a little less benefits for the companies, but it was sold within Bolivia as a nationalization of natural resources. Now, my question is, why don't people see that as what someone said in the panel, that people in Bolivians believe that there was a nationalization? Why don't people see that? And if Morales has chances of winning again, like you've said, when will that realization happen, and what will happen when that comes?
Eric Langer in the back there.
Eric Langer, Georgetown University. Voy a hablar en castellano para que entiendan, porque eso es más que todo para los bolivianos. Como ustedes hablan justamente de nacionalismo aymara y todo eso, en realidad los mayores recursos del gas están en el área indígena de los Abaguaraní. No sé si podrían hablar un poco sobre ellos y cómo la APG o algo así, cómo está actuando dentro de la nueva situación política que da la nueva constitución. Gracias.
Okay, let's take one more question at that table, and then we'll allow our panelists some time to respond because we've had a number of questions now.
Is it on? Kevin Healy, Inter-American Foundation. Tengo una pregunta para René. En su lista de críticas del gobierno de MAS en ser inefectiva o cambio de rumbo, mencionaste el programa agrario y mencionaste tierras, ¿no? Pero creo que no, quiero preguntar, ¿no es un factor dentro de la frustración de MAS o el récord de MAS de ir adelante con una reforma agraria es el poder de Santa Cruz y las grandes movilizaciones para la autonomía que han llevado a cabo? Los medios de comunicación en Santa Cruz son tan en contra de una reforma agraria y que el gobierno, incluso el viceministro, ha sido secuestrado por hacendados en Cordillera, en la provincia de Cordillera. Entonces, hay una fuerte oposición que ayuda a explicar un poco por qué la implementación de la reforma agraria, que hay una ley mucho mejor que la ley INRA, que no se puede implementar porque hay una fuerte oposición. Gracias.
Would you like to start and we'll... Go down the road, please.
Sí, no, los indios, los indígenas, claro que tienen interés en la justicia. Y tienen más interés porque nunca les ha llegado. Este es el problema. Ahora, ¿qué deben hacer los americanos para evitar tantas radicalidades en Bolivia o en otro lado? No meterse. Cuando se han metido nos han perjudicado. Entonces, de ahí vienen las lecciones, así de claro. Ahora, claro, el discurso culturalista de presidente Morales es aymara-céntrico. Pero miren el mito. ¿Quién ha sacado a Sánchez de Lozada, a los indígenas? Movimientos urbano-populares del Alto. Esto hay que tomar en cuenta. Y Evo Morales, obviamente, es amado por todos los indígenas, pero es amado por todos los sectores urbano-populares. Porque los sectores populares, urbano-populares, tienen su piel, su cara y hablan como él. Se sienten representados por él. Por eso amaban en su momento a 1952 al MNR. Y aman a Morales. Y además aman a Morales no solo por sentirlo un símbolo, sino porque reciben los bonos de Evo Morales que se dan a los mayores de 60 años, a los niños de escuelas públicas, a las mujeres embarazadas. Ojo, Evo Morales no es un fenómeno que tenga su votación más alta en sectores indígenas, que son los menores. Su votación fuerte está en centros urbanos populares. Miren el Alto, ahí tiene 90%, 95% de votación. Entonces, hay que ver que es un fenómeno de clases medias urbanos populares. Lo aman los cocaleros, que son profundamente neoliberales. Lo aman todos los contrabandistas, comerciantes minoristas, que son profundamente neoliberales. Y el norte de Evo Morales les dice suma camaña, vivir bien. No, la gente de abajo no quiere suma camaña, no quiere vivir bien. Quiere vivir en mejor, quiere vivir en Washington, en Virginia, en Madrid, en Buenos Aires. Porque tras de cada indígena hay un fenicio, que vende absolutamente todo. No vende al pariente porque no le pagan el mejor precio. Esto es así, y es igual en Perú y es en Ecuador. La intelectualidad masista, o algunos quieren socialismo del siglo XXI, propiedad comunitaria y esas vainas, en realidad lo que quiere la gente de abajo es propiedad privada, pero con respeto de sus culturas, sus usos y sus costumbres. Esta es la realidad. Eso es lo que es. Ahora, la nacionalización, que no se dieron cuenta, es que esta es una data muy fina. Lo que ahora está en Bolivia es la anterior ley de hidrocarburos, 50-50. El presidente Morales no quería nacionalización. Quería llegar al 50-50 entre empresas nacionales y extranjeras. Eso lo planteaba Morales. Pero como él sabe montarse en la ola, tiene un olfato político extraordinario, cuando los movimientos sociales iban más lejos, se montó en la nacionalización. Y dijeron 82-18. Y el 32% sobre el 50% lo recibieron 6 meses hasta cambiar de contratos. Y nacionalización, y bajo la mesa acaban los 32% de demás que les hemos cobrado. Quien quiere entender la política en Bolivia tiene que entender los dobles discursos. Esto es no. Eso hay que entenderlo bien. Si no, uno está oyendo el discurso y cayendo en todo el discurso. Entonces se requiere ver más profundo. Y en términos de recursos naturales, ya hay experiencias por todas partes, Eric. Al final se clienteliza a los sectores populares y se arregla de manera prebendal para que las empresas pasen por donde quieren, en la opción 1. En la opción 2 ni les haces caso, como en el norte de La Paz. Como la empresa es de PDVSA y tiene perforar, ¿qué le importa a los lecos? Claro, a Alan García, el presidente Morales, le decía, cuidado, las empresas transnacionales van a matar indígenas, nos va a hacer daño. Y en Bolivia dice, si no hay inversión extranjera, si no nos dejan perforar pozos, no vamos a poder avanzar. Es no.
With regard to the first question, I agree with Carlos. I think this new wave, this current trend to authoritarian, plebiscitarian, populist regimes cannot be stopped from outside. These are trends which have deep roots in the political histories and processes of the Andean countries, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, and also in Venezuela. So the best advice would be also for the U.S. Government not to intervene. Those regimes have inner problems, inherent contradictions, which I think in 10, 15 years, I don't know, will lead to their breakdown. Populist regimes have not the capability of creating stable power structures and institutions. They fail. And I think Chavez, particularly Chavez, will sometime in the future fail. Raul posed an interesting question. It's not a contradiction, I think, between the ethno-nationalist Aymara ideology and the white support Morales has, as also Carlos argued, in the cities. There's not such a contradiction. The real thing is that Evo Morales' government is supporting the concrete interests of some groups of Bolivian society. First of all, the cocaleros, the smugglers, and the dealers in different sectors of the economy, and most importantly, aside from the ideology, is I think this descriptive representation. The people in El Alto, they feel they are represented by Evo Morales, by culture, by ethnic descent, etc. So I think there's no such a contradiction. Kevin posed also an interesting question. I think it's the cornerstone of Evo Morales' policy, how to destroy or weaken the economic power of Santa Cruz. Carlos stressed very well this schizophrenia, this contradiction between Santa Cruz as economic power of the country and La Paz as the political center of the country. And the key aim of Morales' government, as García Linera often stated, is really to destroy economically the private enterprise, the private entrepreneurs in Santa Cruz. García Linera stated about 2 months ago in an interview in the Le Monde Diplomatique, he argued what he often said. He argued that the mass government has now the political power, thus the mass has overcome its opponents, that the mass has now the political hegemony. And he added, what we have to do now is to destroy the private entrepreneurs in Santa Cruz economically. That means the government is really pointing at strengthening the state economy, the state-led economy, at the expense of the private enterprise. As a radical populist regime, the Evo Morales government is really hostile to private enterprise and also hostile to foreign investments, and I think that will not change if Morales wins now the elections by absolute majority. He will accelerate this political orientation and his state sponsoring policies. There will be no change. Well, I stop here.
Eric, sorry, I don't have a whole lot to offer on the gas Guarani question. But in terms of what can the U.S. do, I think that just as a complement to what's already been said, the problem is the U.S. has done a lot over the years, and it's created a set of expectations and a sort of politics of the normal with respect to how the U.S. is perceived to act and unconstructively. So the low-intensity war on drugs, beginning with Operation Blast Furnace, mid-1980s and so on, has made it difficult for the U.S. to now turn around and be a constructive actor. But I would also say that the other issue is the way in which regime change is being identified in the U.S. policy community, which is to say very generally, very poorly, very non-specifically. So we still hear a lot of discussion of grouping of leftist this and rightist that and centrist this and democratic and non-democratic. Massively simplistic approaches to a much more complex and changing landscape. And so this 100,000-foot view of things that is also from a bygone era is not the best way to create a space for constructive recognitions of the differences among, which I think is the more important thing for people to be thinking about, say, you know, Chavismo in Venezuela and Evismo or any ismo, although I don't think it's a good idea. Evo, I think, has learned that saying Evismo too often doesn't go down well, so he's changing that now. But and that also begins, say, in the Bolivian context with recognizing that there is not an indigenous movement, but a real diversity of indigenous investments and kinds of interests. And I would also extend, I liked very much what Carlos was saying about a kind of indigenous mestizaje, because that really is true. I'm struck by it, particularly having lived and worked in part of Bolivia, not well known for its, you know, stalwart indigenous efforts, which is a Cochabamba area. I lived in Quillacollo, if any of you know that, for 4 or 5 years. And this is not the first place people would think of. And yet what you see there is a strong support for Evo. And the reason is, and the mas, having followed on a period of time of having been very much about another populist phenomenon, the UCS party. I won't explain why that is, but so there's on the one hand the Aymara-centric intellectual policy discourse as it becomes legal and other kinds of programs. And I would agree that that discourse has to be understood as kind of a distinct phenomenon unto itself, and that is different from the incredible electoral success. That had a lot to do with and has had a lot to do with the MAS's unique ability up to that point to provide an expansive umbrella under the aegis of a much more inclusive notion of indigenous participation, where indigeneity was increasingly including what we would have been calling mestizaje and cholaje, the sort of cholos of Quillacollo is a very cholo town, you know, of that participation, you know, is kind of the key story there. So, you know, just very quickly, you know, you have since the mid-80s, an explosive growth of these kind of regional folklore festivals. And these are very kind of folklorized, often with NGO development funds and so forth, and organized at the municipal level. Now it's like an endless weekly rotation of these now, at least in the Cochabamba area. What that means is urban people go to these provincial towns, spend the afternoon there. There's a real sense of kind of my indigenous heritage with relationship to this. And then in the context of, you know, Evo's emergence, see, this was an easy move, you know, from indigenous heritage to supporting a candidate who himself is not altogether, you know, it's an Indo-Mestizo phenomenon. And that's the important thing to note. In terms of nationalization of resources and so on, you know, the hostility to foreign national investment, I think, is often, I mean, there is, we hear things like that, but then we also see in practice a very mixed approach. And so, you know, what you have is inside out and out, and then domestic. And I think that the MAS policies for the repositioning of Bolivia in the global economy is critical here. And one of the things that was key to making that be a popular notion, think of the gas war moment in 2005, was because of the success in applying these same kinds of analogies, the analogies of autonomy, but now to the global context of the global economy, here in the notion of national sovereignty. So sovereignty becomes, you know, the bellwether that registered in a real populist groundswell, where you had Evo creating alliances with the military, you know, to reject certain options that were being put out there that were not popular with respect to the, you know, the Bolivia's relationship to foreign investment, right? So it's the way in which that can be brought into this big tent discourse of expansiveness. What's happening, though, is that now that you have to legislate, that gets more specific. And having to specify, you know, in constitutional legislation and otherwise, that's where we see all the tremendous infighting. And then also, you know, the need to have to specifically identify what we mean and, you know, what is indigenous, what is not indigenous. And then what we see, we have the sort of this Aymara-centric thing suddenly overlaying a much more diverse situation. And how that's going to play out is will be interesting, but I don't think we have any sense of that yet.
I think, unfortunately, we don't have time for any more questions. So please join me in thanking our panelists for a wonderful presentation. And